Well, good evening, everyone. Again, it's really good to see everybody who's willing to sacrifice time midweek over and over again to be together in worship, just to spend time growing in our devotion to the Lord, as is the theme of our series. And tonight, something got lost in translation with the title of my first slide. So we're going to be looking at applying Jesus' authority to your anger. So yesterday we talked about the idea of authority to Jesus was something for him that was deeply personal. So authority wasn't just a concept that involved a pocket of Jesus' life. Authority wasn't just about somewhere Jesus would go. It wasn't just about certain events he would participate in. It didn't just relate to group activity. God's authority dictated how Jesus thought, how he treated people. God's authority was the basis for his emotions, how he handled his passions, difficult interactions. And so the lesson this evening is going to be understanding the necessity of letting God's authority impact us all the way to where it changes our emotions. So we're going to kind of work this lesson. We're going to fly around Jesus is teaching in Matthew 5. We're going to get to Matthew 5 eventually, but we're going to look at some passages that came after Jesus through the apostles, some passages that deal with anger in the Proverbs to kind of emphasize the nature of the problem of anger. And so then we can kind of be more motivated to understand the importance of applying Jesus' solution to the problem of anger. And I just want to emphasize this is not a theoretical kind of lesson. To me, I think the struggle of anger is a little like the struggle of pornography addiction. And by that I mean it's something that I think thrives in secrecy and I think is maybe more common than we realize. And this is something that's very personal for me. I, in my life, have really struggled persistently with anger. I have really struggled persistently with it. Nobody has been hurt more by my struggle of anger than my wife has. You know, my wife has seen me yell. My wife has seen me choose to lose control of my emotion and get very angry. It has scared her. It has traumatized her. And I'm deeply indebted to her to be willing to be patient and forgiving with me. But again, you know, this is something that's very personal to me, and I think, again, the problem of anger is one of those things that needs to be dealt with honestly, and it's best when it's not kept secret or tolerated in secrecy. So it's good to talk about the issue of anger. And look, there's the slide that I thought was missing. So we're going to get to Matthew 5, 21 through 26 eventually. The first passages are going to be on the board. I'd like to try to move through these at somewhat of a brisk pace. You may not think it's as brisk as what I'm thinking, but you can turn to these passages in your Bibles, but I will have them on the board. In Galatians 5, 19 through 21, I think it's critical to note the family of terms that an outburst of anger is listed within and the consequence of these family of terms. So when Paul's writing to the Galatians, he says, "The deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." Did you know that people who don't learn emotional self-control, people who allow themselves to consistently have outbursts of anger and act on their anger, did you know that that's a quality that will keep people out of heaven? And that people will go to hell for outbursts of anger just like they will for sexual immorality? And imagine kind of with these families of terms, imagine you get really tense and things in a situation are just making you feel a lot of emotional pressure. And as you're feeling all of that pressure, you take a little idol out of your pocket and you say, "Help me, Baal. I love you, Baal. I worship you, Baal." And then you put it back in your pocket. They say, "Whoa, what was that?" You say, "Oh, I felt so much pressure. You know, I was getting so upset. So that's why I did that." Would that fly? Would that make any sense to do something like that? But you see, outbursts of anger is listed alongside the sin of idolatry. The point of this is, how sensitive should we be? How convicted should we be with outbursts of anger? We need to be a lot more careful and sensitive that when we realize we have acted inappropriately on our anger, we have yelled, we've shouted, we've said things out of anger, we've lost control, should that be convicting? Should that humble us and motivate us urgently to make amends and to repent? And again, I want to say this. None of these passages mean that anger will be something you won't struggle with, right? I'll argue this, that if you don't struggle with anger, you are not a human being. Either that, or you're not really having the kind of relationships and interactions that God calls you to have. You know, the reality is, we're going to deal with anger. It's how we deal with that anger. It's whether or not we bring Christ's teaching into our anger, right? So none of these passages mean we become robotic and like we've just overcome anger and we don't feel that emotion. That's not the point, right? But what we're dealing with is learning to recognize the danger of anger and learning how to handle that in a more godly and especially Christ-centered way. There's a number of Proverbs. The Proverbs deal with anger a great deal. And so there's a couple of cursory things I want to bring up here about the problem of anger, that the Bible, again, deals with the problem of anger as a problem in ways that I don't think we naturally would assign to it. And so Proverbs 19:19 says, "A man of great anger will bear the penalty. If you rescue him, you will only have to do it again." Did you know that anger is addictive? And that I think people get addicted to acting out on anger? And I think it's like pornography. It's like sexual sin. Because I've dealt with pornography addiction myself. Now, obviously, I've got like a messy past, right? But I've dealt with pornography addiction, and I've realized it works exactly like an outburst of anger. You feel a lot of pressure with the temptation, and ultimately the pressure becomes so great that you think, "I need to do this to find relief." Do you know that's exactly what an outburst of anger is? The pressure is mounting, and the temptation is acting on this, yelling, screaming, hitting, throwing, whatever, that will give me relief. And just like you train yourself by consistently giving in to the sexual temptation, whether that's with your phone or with a person or whatever, you train your mind to associate, "You need this relief." So you get into a similar opportunity or a similar situation, you're in a similar environment, you're in a similar conflict, and your body and your mind are telling you, "You need relief by acting on anger." It's the same thing as sexual sin, right? Anger is an extremely tempting thing, and outbursts of anger are extremely addictive. Proverbs 22:24 through 25, anger is very influential, especially from parents to their children. This is a lesson where I sought counsel from older brethren, just kind of seeking advice on how to think through these points. And an older brother I respect greatly, he said this about parenting. "Because of untempered emotions, a person might be building their house with their right hand and tearing it down with their left hand." And what he meant was, he knew a lot of godly parents, where they were diligent churchgoers, they were faithful in a lot of ways, but in their household had untempered anger. No one will be hurt more by the shrapnel of your explosions of anger. No one will be hurt more than your children. And I've experienced this. My dad became a Christian when he was in college age. He grew up in an abusive household. So his parents, his dad was a World War II veteran. He's a really gritty, tough guy, but his dad was a very angry man and very abusive. My dad would go hunting with his dad, and he literally would think that his dad was taking him out hunting to kill him. He would have traumatic nightmares even as an adult. His dad had passed away for years. He would still have nightmares that his dad was going to kill him. Well, my dad became a Christian in his college years, and when I was growing up, my dad still struggled with anger. He's overcome these things now. I mean, not that he doesn't experience anger, but he's really done a lot of work to apply Christ's teaching in his life, right? So he's changed a lot. But he struggled with anger greatly when I was a kid, and growing up, what I would do when I felt anger is I would hit myself, I would punch myself, I would throw things, I would scream, and I don't just mean when I was five. I mean, when I was a teenager, I would throw things against the wall. So in my early 20s, you know, all of that just continues on, right? Anger is extremely influential. Untempered anger in your household, no one will be hurt more by that than your kids. And then last thing here is Ephesians 4:31. I believe God calls us to be on a mission. I know this might sound strange, maybe a little extreme. But I want you to notice the terms here. In Ephesians 4:31, Paul says, "Let all bitterness and anger and wrath and shouting and slander be put away from you, along with all malice." There's a process, I think, here. Bitterness is the seed of the mind. So it starts in the mind, and then anger is where that seed begins to germinate in the emotion. Wrath is as it begins to be expressed. And then shouting and slander are the expressions now, the damaging expressions of that. So bitterness is where the seed is planted in the mind and in the heart. Anger, it proceeds into feeling. Wrath, it begins to be let loose. Shouting and slander, he says, let all of this be put away from you along with all malice. So we need to spend less time justifying our anger as righteous indignation. And we need to spend more time thinking about anger biblically. I want to think about an example here, because one example that I think we see in Jesus is when he drove out the money changers and the people doing business in the temple. And I would say he was angry in that situation. But I want you to think about that. When Jesus did that in anger, was he having an outburst? Jesus, when he drove out the money changers, was he undermining God's will, or was he fulfilling God's will? Jesus had the control when he felt things strongly, still sought to fulfill God's will with his emotion. So putting away anger is not saying, again, we're not going to feel anger. What it means is everything we do with anger should be ensuring that what we do is a fulfillment of God's will, not a contradiction of God's will. Remember James, where it says the anger of man does not achieve to the righteousness of God, right? So we just need to be more careful with our anger. And I would say we're on a mission to put away all anger. And again, put away doesn't mean you will not feel it, but it means when you are angry, that's when it matters the most to remember what God has to say about that subject. So let's get to Jesus' teaching on anger. Anger is a problem. You know, I've seen people who were ravaging, violent alcoholics, had no concern about the destructive effects of alcohol or drugs on themselves, but when they understood how it was destroying other people they cared about, how it was destroying relationships they cared about, now they're motivated to do something about that. When we understand the way that anger hurts other people and hurts our relationship with the Lord, if we really understand that, what should that do to your motivation to put those things to death and put them away, right? So turn to Matthew 5:21-22. So I'm not going to let you cheat anymore and put this on the board. So you'll need to turn in your Bibles there with me. But I want you to think about this carefully, okay? So this is Jesus' first sermon in Matthew. And in Matthew 5, verse 3 through verse 20, Jesus has been laying the groundwork of principles meaning the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn. Those are principles. They aren't necessarily direct application, they're principles. You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. A principle. Do you think it enhances a point Jesus makes that it is the first practical point he addresses in his first sermon? The Sermon of the Mount of all sermons. I would argue the Sermon on the Mount, I know this might sound like a weird way to classify something in the Bible, but I would argue the Sermon on the Mount is the most important sermon in the whole Bible. And that if someone just really understands and applies the Sermon on the Mount, it's like what Jesus says at the end when he says, if you hear these things and do them, it's like building your house on a rock and you have a secure foundation. I believe that. So, okay, what I would say is the most important sermon in the Bible, the very first practical application Jesus makes. And what is it about? Read with me, Matthew 5, 21. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not murder. Whoever murders shall be guilty before the court. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Sanhedrin. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponents at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. Therefore, or truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last quadrants. It's one thing to say you respect the Lord's authority. It's another thing to submit to the Lord's authority in this way. And I would argue more important than affirming with your words that you respect God's authority is affirming with your life that you will submit to these things the way that the Lord commands. So fundamentally, Jesus commands me to dramatically change the way I recognize and respond to the danger of anger. So you notice how Jesus pulls in the accountability here. You know, in verse 21, you've heard it was said, you shall not murder. Most translations say anyone guilty or anyone who is guilty of murder shall be liable to the court. And it's the idea that, well, you know, it's suspected you might be guilty, so you'll go to court and it'll be discussed by a judge and there'll be other judges there and they'll weigh out your case. And who knows, maybe the justice system will fail and maybe you're guilty, but you'll not be found guilty. Who knows? You know, you'll be liable to the court, but, you know, the court will have to decide that. Do you notice here that Jesus pulls an accountability where it's not up to any mystery or human error whether or not there's a problem here? The idea is Jesus does not grant me the liberty to justify my anger. Jesus says, if you're angry with your brother, how should you feel about that? You are in danger. Hence Ephesians 4, that if you feel anger, it's not the first thing to say, well, I'm justified. No, it's to recognize that you're in a dangerous position and need to be really careful. Ephesians 4 also says, be angry and do not sin. And by the way, it's not giving permission to be angry. It's saying when you're angry, you're going to feel anger, right? God gives us a built-in sense of justice. You're going to deal with anger and deal with it often. Be angry and yet do not sin and do not give the devil an opportunity. When you feel anger, you are in a dangerous position. And if you act on your anger without caution, without self-control, without remembering the teaching of the Lord, it is very likely the devil is going to get an opportunity to do damage and use you to do it. So are you going to let him do that? Anger is dangerous, again, because we always feel like I'm angry for a reason. I'm angry because they did what's wrong. And they did that to me, or they've done something that they shouldn't have done. But I want you to think about some examples here. God tried to appeal to two figures. I want to use this as an illustration for this. In Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel both brought sacrifices before God, but Cain and his offering found no favor before the Lord, and Cain's countenance dropped. This made Cain angry. God asked him a question. Why are you angry? What is God trying to do with Cain? Think about your anger. Look within yourself. Call your anger into question. Again, we're prone to very quickly validate our anger rather than asking ourselves the questions that God has asked people. Am I really right to feel this anger? And of course, Cain didn't listen. Cain would not look within himself, and so Cain then proceeded to murder his brother. Jonah. Jonah really wanted those Ninevites to die. And the Ninevites were a very violent people toward the Jewish people, the Israelites. So Jonah went eventually to preach to Nineveh. You know, in 40 days, Nineveh will fall. And they repented, from the king down to the common people. Even the animals were made to fast. And God spared Nineveh. This made Jonah angry. You know what God did with Jonah? He said, is it right for you to be angry? Jonah affirmed, yep, it's right. And you could imagine, this is righteous indignation. The Ninevites are evil people who've done sinful things, and they've wronged God's nation. They've done horrible things. So imagine Jonah could say, I feel righteous indignation. Well, Jonah goes and makes himself a little insufficient hut. And God instigates Jonah's anger further by giving shelter with a plant. God then appoints a little worm to eat away the plant. Sun scorches Jonah, makes Jonah angrier, and God asks him again, is it right for you to be angry? With Cain and Jonah, God wanted them to question their right to anger, not to validate their right to anger. And again, this is just my experience, but I think, again, we spend way too much time validating our anger too quickly and presumptuously as righteous indignation. Any anger we feel over anything, because of course we're angry for reasons we feel are right. It's wrong, they're wrong, that's not right, that's immoral. Again, we give into anger far too easily. We need to learn to see the blessing of humbling ourselves. You know, so with what Jesus teaches here about pulling in the accountability that if you speak in an insulting way towards someone, you're angry with your brother, then know that God's judgment is already cast on the matter, and you can know that. If you believe that, does that mean you'll feel less conviction in your life or more conviction? Again, as we are going to feel anger frequently, and I know this might sound bad, I really don't mean it in a bad way, but when you really start investing yourself with brethren who are different than you and really trying to invest in the development of their faith and form relationships that aren't comfortable, brethren will make you struggle with anger. You know that's a good thing? You know that's okay? Relationships will make us struggle with anger. Again, what do we do with that? Does Jesus' teaching mean we'll feel less conviction or more conviction? Is that a bad thing or a good thing? I would argue, really abiding by what Jesus says here will bring more guilt into your life. But like we talked about on Sunday, can guilt be a bridge to grace? Can grace help you productively embrace conviction and guilt? I would say that's exactly how the grace of God works. Before we move on here, go back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 3. This is a critical reference. Like I said in Luke, it's the same thing for Matthew, Luke 6, Matthew 5. Jesus' applications force us to dig deeper into the initial principles. What does Jesus say in Matthew 5, verse 3? Woe to you who are poor in spirit. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Woe to you who mourn. No, blessed are you who mourn. You know what? You feel conviction because of your anger? Well, blessed are you, because blessed are the people who feel poor in spirit. Blessed are the people who mourn over their sin. That draws them closer to the Lord, not further away. The point isn't that this is natural. The point isn't that this makes sense to you. The point isn't that this is how you would think on your own or how you would make decisions about your anger. That is not the point. The point is this is the opposite of what you want to do. This is the opposite of how you want to feel about your anger, and glory to God for that. Because isn't that more humbling? That God is calling you to deny yourself then and adapt his thinking and not your own? And giving into anger destroys healthy communication. So we see that again in verse 32, or rather 22. Anyone who insults his brother rockets, the idea of, you know, saying you're fool or you're empty-headed. You know, it's the idea of undermining someone's value as a human being. Speaking of someone in a way that is dishonorable, it undermines their identity as someone created in the image of God, someone that is valuable to God. When Jesus came on the earth and died on the cross, what is that emphasizing about the value of even sinful human beings in God's sight? What is the value of every person created in the image of God? Again, to control ourselves, to adapt these things, to heed the warning, helps us think more like Jesus. These warnings are closing doors that destroy our hearts and closing doors that destroy the hearts of other people. And the doors that are left open are doors of healing, restoration, fellowship, kindness, gentleness, love. You know, Jesus isn't trying to make our lives harder. He's trying to create a pathway to healing and restoration, to peacemaking. Now, these things are challenging, okay? But I want to put this in perspective with an illustration. When I was 16, I got in an ATV accident, a four-wheeler, where I almost died, and I spent over 2 weeks in the hospital. I had a collapsed lung among many other problems. It was really, really bad. I had to get a helicopter ride to a big hospital. When I woke up, I had to do a lot of things that hurt. I had to get pushed by doctors and nurses and my family to do things that hurt. And why did I do those things? Because I needed to restore the health and the movements of my body. And if I just laid down, my body was going to lock up. I was not going to heal. You know, God calls us to do things that are hard, but why? Because the things that Jesus teaches about the restoration of our condition. It's hard, but that's the point. It's about perspective of faith. You know, Jesus' teaching isn't just about validating us in our current condition. He is taking broken people who are carrying the baggage of a sinful life, and the glory that is given to him is he takes those people and transforms them into people who are like him in their life. But that's a process of painful restoration. It's hard, but that's the point. Okay? Some proverbs that deal with this as well. Jesus is the fulfillment of the wisdom of the Proverbs. You know, these are two passages that are just so helpful to memorize that I think Jesus is getting to in his sermon here. There is one who speaks rashly like the thrusts of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. You know, something that we need to be really careful with is our words. Jesus said in Matthew, I believe it's Matthew 12, he said, man will give an account for every careless word in the judgment. You know, the culture of the world tells you, you can say whatever you want, very little consequence. You know, people will gossip about each other and slander each other with no consequence. They'll pat each other on the back, say, yeah, that's right. The tongue of the wise brings healing. When we feel anger, we need to be really careful of what we say. A gentle answer turns away wrath. A harsh word stirs up anger. Another brother that I sought counsel from on this lesson mentioned that in his household, he has a zero-tolerance policy for yelling. He said, in our family, yelling is only if there is a real emergency. But other than that, there is a zero-tolerance policy. Because he's recognized that anger stirs up more anger. Just think about it. Let's say your kids are angry. Anger plus anger equals what? More anger. Now, again, parenting is tough. I'm not a parent, but I get it, right? Like, people are tough. Responding to tense things is tough. But again, we just have to find a way to ensure that in our life, we are having that obedience-oriented mentality and not, well, what about this? But this is so hard. And what about this situation? Just do what God says. And learn wisdom by being willing to do, not by trying to find a way around. Matthew 5, 23 through 26. Notice in verse 23, in my translation, he says, therefore, your translation might say, so. I think he's still dealing with the issue of anger and resolving the problem of anger. That if we want to be serious about really dealing with this issue, and by the way, Jesus' teaching, his teaching first demands faith, but when we apply his teaching, it digs deep into our hearts and changes our heart. So this is related to anger, anger's relation to the heart, but also solving the deepest heart issues at work at anger. If we want to deal with anger by Jesus' authority, here's a part of how that works, verse 23. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you. Note that. Not that you have something against your brother. Your brother has something against you. Leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. I want to think realistically about the situation Jesus is describing here. So you're bringing your offering to the altar. So in the Old Testament context, that means you've made a trip to Jerusalem. Who knows how far away you live from Jerusalem? But that would be an undertaking. You've made a trip to Jerusalem to go to the approved altar to offer an animal sacrifice there. So you've already invested all of this time. You've got your animal. You're already there. You're already with the priest. You've stood in line to get to the altar, like waiting in line at Disney World or something. You're finally there, and you remember that brother so-and-so has an issue with you. Does Jesus say, make your offering and then go make that right? How incredible. Leave your offering there. Tell the priest, I just remembered something. Can you please hold on to this? I'll be back. And I'll come make this offering. Here's the thing. What is true worship meant to accomplish with our relationships? If worship is not motivating you to reconcile hurt relationships, you are not worshiping in a true way. If you have lingering conflicts that you are leaving unresolved, conflicts you can resolve. Like, I get it. I have people in my past where it's like, I don't know how to find all the people I hurt when I fell away. Look, I get it, right? But again, obedience-oriented mentality. It's not, well, what about, well, what if, well, my situation, well, this. What did Jesus say? What's this illustration teaching? If true worship is not motivating you to make things right, then you are not worshiping in a true way. If you are not willing to go out of your way to reconcile relationships that are hurt, then Jesus' authority is not being applied properly in your life. And I'll tell you, I have had too many older brethren who have been in the faith for decades who have people in their life that I know have a problem with them, and there's this long-standing conflict. And I've had them say to me, older brethren, if they have a problem with me, then they need to come to me. Is that what Jesus is teaching here? And by the way, that reason makes sense naturally, right? That totally makes sense. If they have a problem with me, they need to come to me. Is that Christ-like? You know, did God say, you know what? Them down there, they're the sinners. And they're the ones that have a problem with me. I'm innocent. You know, they've got to make the first step to me. Was that God's prerogative? Was that how God handled things? Absolutely not. You know, we've got to humble ourselves. It will feel foolish to do this. That's the point. It will feel humiliating to do this. That's the point. You're going to have to communicate if you do this. And struggling with that communication, that's the point. And then look at verse 25. Make friends quickly with your opponents at law while you're on the way with him, so that your opponent not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last quadrants. You know what's interesting about the situation? Why are you going to court with your enemy? Because you're going to win.
because there's an argument to be made. But what does Jesus say in verse 26? You know, wisdom acts now on what is certain about the future. Does Jesus leave it up to uncertainty in verse 26? You know, Jesus says, you've already lost. And you're only going to lose more the farther on you go. You know why you continue conflicts? I'm right. They're wrong. You know, in 1 Corinthians 6, the Corinthians were taking each other to court. And Paul says, you know, isn't there even just a wise man among you who could resolve the situation? But he goes further. He says, it's actually already a loss that you've allowed these things to escalate. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather just suffer the loss? But that requires that you want the mind of Christ. That makes no sense, no natural sense. And you're going to feel like a fool. The only way to truly overcome anger is to surrender justice. And isn't that what Jesus did on the cross? You know, justice may be one of the most important qualities about who God is. But you know what the cross is? It's God letting go of what justice demands in our relationship so that we can reconcile the relationship. He pays the price. He takes the initiative. He does it all. Jesus suffered because God was releasing his sense of justice. Later on in the chapter, it'll say, someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other to him also. Give to everyone who asks of you. Love your enemies. The only way you can do those things is if you learn to let go of your personal sense of justice. Is that going to make sense? No. Is that going to feel foolish? Yes. I'm going to use a strong word here. Is that going to make you feel like an idiot? Yeah. That's the point. Jesus became a fool on the cross. So that our perception of what relationships mean, how to think about something that can seem so small as anger, how that could be transformed in everyday situations. We'll end it there a little bit early. Thank you for your patience as we work through that. Not early.